Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Right now, we continue with our right and left constitutional scholars, Ilya Shapiro from the Libertarian Cato Institute and Nate Persily, professor at the Columbia University Law School. And as promised, it's time for some listener-nominated favorite constitutional passages to get the takes from both our guests. We've been asking you to write in or call in with your favorites. So, Nate, Ilya, meet Amber Pinter of Fayetteville, Arkansas. Amber, welcome to WNYC. Hello.
Hello. Thank you, Brian.
And you wrote in with another part of Article 1, Section 8, which contains the Commerce Clause. Go ahead.
Well, I chose subsection 15, which is, quote, to provide for the calling forth of the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. And I chose this because I'm from Little Rock, Arkansas, and this clause spoke to me in the use of the federal government's military force in the integration of Central High School.
Is there a liberal or conservative view on this? So long after the integration of schools in Little Rock, Arkansas, at the point of a gun of federal troops, Ilya?
Well, I also commented that this power was not enforced or not used by the Congress or President Jackson in terms of Indian removal in support of the Cherokee Nation in the 1830s, and we also had the Trail of Tears across our state in the 1830s as a result of the lack of using this power to enforce the laws. I just found it interesting. I think it's in the eye of the beholder, and one of your earlier guests referred to the lack of police powers, and I have to disagree with him. We obviously do have the right as a country to enforce martial law using subsection 15.
Yeah, so Ilya from Cato, on this, and to read again from this subsection 15, Congress has the power to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. Is it worth noting that many gun rights advocates interpret the Second Amendment as allowing for the formation of militia to create insurrections, you know, or at least to protect against government intrusion?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, that's kind of like the right to revolution, which is we're getting very philosophical and high-minded, you know, extra-constitutional, you know, whether it's warranted, whatnot. But getting back to the concrete question here, the desegregation of Central High School was actually, Nate can correct me, but I believe that's Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. That is, the court decided that segregation was in education was unconstitutional. You know, separate is inherently not equal, and so forth. And so Congress was, or the federal government was enforcing the law. It wasn't suppressing an insurrection or an invasion. Indeed, when it does suppress, invasions, Pearl Harbor or what have you, get involved in military actions, that's always in the power to raise armies and the commander-in-chief power under Article 2 and all of that. So the government does enforce its laws, often at the point of a gun. You know, they arrest people and all that. It comes under the necessary and proper clause, that the government can do everything that's necessary and proper to fulfill its lawfully enumerated powers. Now, as for the Trail of Tears and the Cherokee Nation, there could have been some unconstitutional behavior going on there, certainly immoral and bad policy and so forth. But I don't think that's the clause that's implicated there. And again, Nate can correct me. And finally, on the police power, that doesn't mean the police as we think it, the men in blue. Police power means legislating for the health, safety, welfare, and morals of the population, kind of a broad grant of power that rests with the states, but not in the enumerated powers of the federal government.
So let me leave that there and thank Amber for calling in from Fayetteville, Arkansas. We really, really appreciate your participation. And we go to our next Constitution reader, and that's Catherine Dupuis. Catherine, meet our two scholars, Ilya Shapiro and Nate Persily, and tell us about your nomination.
Well, I'm back at the Commerce Clause, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3. I am part Ojibwa Mohawk, and I always have to remember how much of the Constitution speaks to the fact that the Indian peoples were considered foreign nations with the original writers of this document. And unfortunately, in the history of our country since that time, that hasn't always been kept up by the government, by the Congress, and by the courts. In fact, so much still remains in the court because the original treaties have never been followed. And then the second question that I have, which deals with this same clause, is the stuff that's happening today in New York State, but in many other states, about the fact that goods and services and commerce is happening on the Indian lands, and it's not taxable by the state authorities because sales tax is a state issue, not a federal issue, and the only jurisdiction over the Indian peoples on this continent in this country is the federal government. It is not. There is no state jurisdiction over any Indian people.
So, Nate from Columbia University, can you weigh in on any of this?
Well, there's several clauses in the Constitution dealing with Indian tribes. It talks about representation, not including
right.
Indians, not taxed. At the same place where it talks about other persons, particularly African Americans or slaves being 3/5 of other persons. So that, the original document is very explicit as to who is included and who is excluded. And we have a series of amendments to deal with that and to grant citizenship more broadly, whether on the basis of race and the 14th Amendment, the elimination of slavery in the 13th Amendment, and then the protections of the 14th Amendment with privileges and immunities and equal protection of the laws. And so, yes, Indian tribes continue to have a special status because of both the history of treaties and the fact that they are seen in some respects as separate nations. But the original document is very different than what it is as amended once we have the 13th and 14th Amendments.
And maybe one thing to note is that the 14th Amendment, which famously removed the 3/5 clause and granted citizenship to blacks, did not initially do the same for Native Americans. It was only wasn't until the Indian Citizenship Act many years later that happened. So what do you make in the way in which the Constitution continues to affect our relationship with Indians? Does Cato ever look at this, Ilya?
We do occasionally, and it's difficult because the Indian provisions in the Constitution are an accommodation with pre-constitutional realities. We weren't building on a tabula rasa, on a blank slate. And so we had to accommodate this idea of there being other sovereigns which weren't quite like France and Britain and other countries that the framers were more used to dealing with, or there were set rules and established international law and so forth. So even to this day, it's somewhat problematic that, as you said, the Native Americans have the right to vote in U.S. elections, but then they're also a sovereign. So how can you have these conflicting sovereignties? And it's a very tricky and complicated issue from a matter of first principles or from constitutional law. And I'm not sure the right balance has been struck, given that so much of Indian law disputes these days have to do exactly with taxation of gaming and so forth, and not the types of concerns that the Native Americans had back in the day when they were first interacting with the colonialists and the new country.
All right, we're talking about the Tea Party's favorite clauses of the Constitution and yours. And next on the line with us is David, who wants to bring up Article 6. Hi, David.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yes, Article 6 is most relevant to me because I'm an atheist, but I'd like to point out that I think what it does is imply that the Constitution was bringing together this country on a set of common principles, common values, and the founders deliberately wanted to avoid having religion interfere with that set of common values, if that makes sense.
Nate?
Well, the provision that the caller is referring to says that no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. That's the less famous religion clause in the First Amendment, which provides that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And so that the First Amendment, which most people focus on, right, was a revolution in many ways because of its prohibition, both of government involvement, or federal at least, involvement in establishing religion, but also the protection of people's ability to freely exercise their religion. So it was, you know, there's a reason that amendment comes first.
And let's take one more call. Anne in Greenwich, you're on WNYC. Hello, Anne.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
When I hear discussions about the constitutionality of various issues, I have a concern that's on a more basic level, which is, while it is a wonderful and admirable thing to have our country based on the Constitution, I feel as if we should remember that the Constitution was not handed down by God at the beginning of the world. It was created by fallible men and may need to be corrected by fallible men. To me, the question is not, should not be whether it is constitutional, but is it obviously best for the health and safety and et cetera of the people? And what supports me in this view is the ridiculous necessity to hang crimes like murder and robbery on the Interstate Commerce Clause. Well, that's clearly a ridiculous situation. You know, the Constitution, if it needs to be invoked, it should be taking care of us in the ways that we need to be taken care of. And if it has to be changed, so be it. I just don't feel as if it should be treated as if it is carved in stone and has been forever.
Right. Of course, changing the Constitution, amending the Constitution, is a much more complicated process that involves a large majority of the states and a large majority of both houses of Congress than passing a simple federal law. But why don't you each give us a last thought on that as kind of an overarching principle? I think we could probably hear from a lot of people in our area who would say the same thing as Anne in Greenwich. Nate Persily.
Well, again, starting from first principles, if we do go with the vision of the Constitution that was realized at the time of the framing, then things like the right to vote, racial equality, women's equality, and a whole host of other protections that we have come to assume are sort of part of the fabric of the country go away. Now, there is a sort of purist argument that, well, if you want those protections, then you need to amend the Constitution. But that train has left the station. And to sort of go back and to try and recreate a time which may never even really have existed, and in which, you know, sort of for a country that was very different than our own, is going to be extremely difficult, if not completely impossible.
And a last word, Ilya Shapiro.
Well, we have to remember why we care about the Constitution. That's because that's where the government gets its legitimate use of power. Without the Constitution, it's just a lot of people, you know, the majority ganging up with guns. So if we care about the Constitution in that way, then we should follow the amendment procedures when we want to change it. And I agree with Nate that, you know, women's rights and the right to vote, regardless of race and all of those things, are good things. And indeed, there were constitutional amendments to get those through. The post-Civil War amendments, the 13th, 14th, 15th amendments, perfected the Constitution in the terms of many scholars, because the original framers had to make this compromise with slavery. It wasn't until after the Civil War that we could guarantee civil rights against state violation, not just federal. So those are good things. But as we discussed before, during the New Deal, the Supreme Court started going off the tracks and amending the Constitution in effect without having a constitutional amendment, at the strong behest of the Roosevelt administration, who would send up notes to Congress, for example, saying, don't let any constitutional qualms prevent you from voting from this very good legislation. And that's the wrong way to go about doing things. Now, I'm a constitutional guy. I'm not a healthcare policy expert or an economic policy expert. So if we want to do something that's unconstitutional, you know, have that debate about whether we should amend the Constitution in that way, and then my constitutional arguments fall away, and it's just a matter of a political debate.
Well, we will see if the Roberts Court takes up that challenge to roll back constitutional interpretation to pre-FDR times. And we thank Ilya Shapiro from the Libertarian Cato Institute. We thank Nate Persily, professor of law at Columbia University, for fielding questions from our listeners on their favorite passages in the Constitution, as well as talking about what's being debated in Washington right now. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC AM and FM New York, AM 820, 93.9 FM, and WNYC.org.